Shares of Plug Power are on a strong run, up for six straight sessions ahead of the company's much-awaited annual symposium today. Before that symposium kicks off at 10 a.m., Plug Power is announcing the acquisition of Applied Cryo Technologies. Let's check in with Plug Power CEO Andy Marsh on this key day for the company. Yahoo Finance's Akiko Fujita is here as well. Good morning to you both. Andy, I'll start with you here. Big acquisition by your company this morning. Why'd you pull the trigger?
Oh, Brian, when we look at it, Plug's built out the first green hydrogen network in the United States. And we've been vertically integrating for a number of years. Company's been around for 25 years. You know, we're promoting 500 tons of green hydrogen in the U.S. by 2025. A key technology is cryogenics. Hydrogen likes to be really cold to be able to transport it and move it. And this gives us capability of really filling out our vertical integration strategy for hydrogen storage, as well as for hydrogen transportation. So that's why we took the step.
Yeah, Andy, it feels like you've had an announcement every day this week in the lead up to the symposium. Certainly investors have liked the news. You're announcing a number of partnerships today as well, including one with Airbus as well as Airflow. Talk to me about, you know, what you see there, because it sounds like it's still in the exploratory phase, but there's a lot of people looking to hydrogen potentially fueling planes in the future.
Absolutely, Akiko. When you think about it, I think one of the reasons Airbus came to us because we've actually been the most aggressive about building out green hydrogen. And as Airbus says, you know, and they'll be talking today at the Plug Power Symposium, that the best solution long term for aircrafts is actually hydrogen. You know, 2 to 3% of carbon for the world is emitted by aircraft. And they look at North America as the prime market. They've decided to partner with Plug Power to really think through how you convert airports to hydrogen. And we'll be picking one over the coming years to start converting to hydrogen. So that's why they're working with us. And, you know, I think they're long term, but there's markets that are here today. You know, not the sexiest market in the world, but we start by building hydrogen ecosystems for forklift trucks. 25% of food in the U.S. actually moved through our products during COVID. We're on-road vehicles. Today, we're announcing our vehicle with Renault in France, which is a joint venture between Plug Power and Renault for European commercial vehicles. We have activity going on with Acciona to generate green hydrogen in the Iberia Peninsula. So we have lots and lots of news today. But, you know, we're real. Akiko, I mean, we've been doing this for 25 years. We use more hydrogen than anyone else in the world for transportation. And this is really just an extension of our mission.
Specifically on the planes, how close are we to seeing hydrogen fuel planes on a larger scale?
Yeah. So, you know, I think when you look at Airbus, they're talking about 2035. The work we're doing with Universal Hydrogen, actually, there will be trial flights by the end of next year. So where they'll be converting the Havilland aircraft to for regional flights to hydrogen. So, you know, it's it can be done. You know, I think, as you know, the cycle for, you know, airplanes is not overnight, but Universal Hydrogen has come up with a really cool conversion kit that will really start the journey to make hydrogen aircraft. So we're really excited. We have a drone business. We have a regional aircraft business that we work with people on. And now we're really excited about providing green hydrogen to Airbus.
At what point does hydrogen become competitive with oil and gas from a cost perspective? And what's the technology or what's necessary to get there?
Okay. So there's three elements. One is, and this is the most important one, is really tight. So let me tell you how you make green hydrogen. You use a device called an electrolyzer, which takes water, H2O, and splits off the hydrogen. So one of the key items is, and the key biggest driver is the cost of renewable electricity. When a renewable electricity is in the range of 3 cents a kilowatt hour, you start to be competitive with natural gas generated hydrogen. A second item that's really important is bring down the cost of the equipment. We make electrolyzers, and we found that every time you double the number of units in the field, the costs come down 25%. And in Europe, they're looking to deploy over 40 gigawatts by 2030. And the third item, which is I think everybody would, especially listening to this show, would understand, it's the cost of capital. And as this technology becomes more and more mature, just like solar and wind, you're going to see the cost of capital for these big projects come down.
Andy, speaking of numbers, the deals for your company appear to just be accruing here. You know, how much in billings growth will the company do over the next 12 months?
I think, Brian, I'm going to tell you to look for a news release around 9:29 today that'll announce our projections for
the
next year.
And you're only 5 minutes away.
I'll tell my folks to work hard to get that out before the interview's over, Brian.
Andy, let's talk about the infrastructure bill over in D.C., the legislation setting aside about $8 billion in spending to establish four regional clean hydrogen hubs. I know you've been very busy in building out your infrastructure here in the U.S. You've got one plant planned over in Fresno as well. How much of that funding you think Plug Power can tap into, and what does that ultimately mean for your ability to scale up in the U.S.?
Sure. I think the hydrogen hubs are really important for the future. And a good deal of the work, when you think about the work we're doing with Airbus, is really thinking about a hydrogen hub at an airport, which will not only support planes, but can support ground support equipment at airports, can support the vans which run around airports. So that bill is important to helping accelerate America's leadership in hydrogen and fuel cells. Now, I would just kind of add also, one of the speakers today at our forum will be Senator Schumer. And it's not only the infrastructure bill, there's bills moving along in both the Senate and House, which supports a $3 a kilogram tax credit for green hydrogen, which is like, so a kilogram of green hydrogen is like 2 gallons of gasoline. So it's very, very competitive. And, you know, those sort of bills and extension of the investment tax credit like solar and wind have will also really help this market accelerate for the U.S. and create lots and lots of jobs in this country.
Well, good luck at the event today. Plug Power CEO Andy Marsh, I'm waiting for it to be 9:29. That financial news is about to cross the wires. We'll bring it to you live. And thank you, of course, to Yahoo Finance's Akiko Fujita. The ongoing recovery in bars and restaurants globally from the worst of the pandemic continues to be a tailwind for Constellation Brands. In the most recent quarter, Constellation called out particular strength in Corona, Modelo, and higher-end wines. It did, however, have to write down some hard seltzer inventory due to that market's continued slowdown. Let's check in with Constellation Brands President and CEO Bill Newlands. Bill, always nice to see you here. What is the state of bars and restaurants? Because I see another good quarter out of you guys in Modelo and Corona. How do you see things out there?
It depends a lot on the market, Brian. Some markets are returning to almost normalcy and others aren't. What you're seeing is 4 out of 5 meals are still being consumed at home, which is disproportionately high compared to what it was before the pandemic started. And about a third of people are not going out as often as they used to. So again, you see variation going on within that particular market. So unfortunately, there's not a one size fits all answer to that.
You know, I did get the sense, Bill, from listening to the conference call that consumer tastes are changing, whether that's in hard seltzer. We'll talk more about that in a second. But consumers are demanding certain things. What changes are you seeing from consumers right now?
You consistently see lower calorie, lower carbs. Obviously, our premier from Corona addresses that particular issue. But you also see higher flavor interest. We've noted in the seltzer consumer that more and more consumers are looking for more flavor. And we're bringing that to them. Our Refresca product under Corona has done extremely well. Our Limonada seltzer goes right after that market as well. So it's a bit of a changing dynamic where consumers are asking for more flavor.
Hey, Bill, it's Julie here. You know, that definitely stuck out to me when I was looking over your conference call, that discussion about seltzer and increasing flavor. Is that another way of saying that hard seltzer in its first iteration just didn't taste that great?
It depends on how you want to answer that. Some people like something that has limited flavor. It really depends. What we are finding is more and more consumers are looking for a little more richness and a little more flavor in seltzer. And admittedly, seltzer is fairly bland, or it can be. So this gives a real opportunity to enhance the flavor characteristics. And that's exactly what we're doing going forward.
Bill, there appears to be a shakeout happening right now in hard seltzer. How committed are you to hard seltzer?
We're committed, although keep in mind, it's still a relatively small proportion of our overall business. Our main business growth is still going to come from our beer business, our core beer business, led by Modelo. But we still think that the seltzer business is going to be an important part, albeit at a smaller growth profile than what everybody had predicted.
So let's talk about that beer business then, because you guys saw a big quarter for beer last quarter. How are you going to continue to expand market share there in the sort of traditional business? Is it about geographics? Is it about expanding in existing markets? How are you guys attacking that?
Modelo is clearly our leader, and Modelo has a lot of tailwinds. First of all, it's very strong in the Hispanic community, which is a growing sector of the overall market. Secondly, the household penetration for Modelo is still relatively small compared to even Corona, never mind some of the other brands. So while Modelo is up 17% in the quarter, the opportunity for the future remains immense. And then you think about brands like Pacifico, which smells a little bit like a young Modelo. It's the number 7 beer in the state of California and growing, and it's expanding across the United States. But don't forget Corona Extra. Corona Extra was the second fastest growing share gainer in the quarter for us. So again, our beer portfolio, our core beer portfolio is just doing outstanding. And we're putting the right capital investment in the ground to make sure we can continue to meet demand.
Bill, really the whole beverage industry continues to deal with inflation. It's transportation, it's glass bottles, it's aluminum cans. You know, how much have you had to raise prices because of this inflation?
We have always said we're going to raise prices 1% to 2%. We're probably toward the high end of that this year, not because we raised overall pricing, but we added some SKUs into the mix where we raised price. So our price realization will be a little bit better. But we also work very hard to hedge ourselves against a number of things. As you probably know, we co-own a glass plant in Mexico, and that certainly helps mitigate any challenges around glass. And we are hedged at about the 65% level on aluminum. So we work very hard to make sure, although, as you acknowledge, there's a lot of inflationary pressure out there.
And what about on the trucking front and getting product where you need to go? You guys aren't as subject, perhaps, to some of the port congestion because you're just taking it across the border. But are you finding that you have enough people to transport the product?
Largely, yes. Although we have had some issues with port as it relates to bringing some of our wines in from overseas. But much of our shipping is done via rail in our beer business, and therefore it's been a little bit less of a challenge for us than perhaps some other players.
Bill, hop water. Talk to me about it. You mentioned it on the call, fell under one of your innovation categories. What is this drink, and what else are you working on in your pipeline?
Hop water is one of our newest venture investments. As you know, we have a venture arm that invests in things that we think have potential for the future. And hop water is one of those. This brings some unique characteristics to the table that can help with stress and brain clarity. We believe it's an interesting opportunity. And we decided to make a minority investment in this and give it a chance to have a run.
And Bill, you know, I know that this is minority and it's early stage, et cetera, et cetera. There are a number of these new beverages out there. There's something called psychedelic water. They just put that right on the package. There's Kin, which whose CEO we talked to a couple of years ago. They have something called nootropics. It's basically herbs, plants, et cetera, that are supposed to evoke a feeling. At some point, is the FDA going to come in here and regulate these things? Because as of now, I don't believe they are very regulated.
I think it's always important, and this is part of the reason we invested in hop water, that you invest in things that are legitimate and that are very carefully run. And hop water certainly fit into that in our judgment. It's always important, and the consumer always looks for something in which they can have confidence and trust. And that's exactly why we chose to invest in Hopwater, because you're absolutely correct. It's important to make sure that you've invested in the right players who are putting the right thing in front of the consumer.
Bill, you had me at stress-relieving drinks. Sign me up for 36-pack. Constellation Brands President and CEO Bill Newlands, have a great weekend. Cheers.
Mindbody has agreed to buy ClassPass. Now, Mindbody is a platform for booking workout and health classes. ClassPass is a subscription service to book workout classes and other types of classes for that matter. So now the two are coming together. Financial terms not disclosed here, but we're joined by Josh McCarter, Mindbody CEO, to talk about the deal. Morning, Josh. Tell us about how these two are going to integrate. I'm someone who has used both platforms. And so I'm curious for the users now, what that experience is going to look like.
So with Mindbody, Mindbody is best known probably for our B2B application. And from that lens, for the businesses that use Mindbody, there's not going to be a lot of differences. Now, what we're looking for on the consumer side is for those Mindbody businesses that don't participate with ClassPass, that will now be able to offer more of their inventory if they elect to participate with ClassPass. We also have a very large consumer marketplace with Mindbody, where millions of consumers are searching and booking for classes, but it's not a membership product and it's not at a discount. And so for those consumers that are looking for that variety through a membership with discounts, then we also hope to be able to offer that to the Mindbody consumer base as well.
And so for the sort of B2B offering, as you're trying to incentivize more of the Mindbody customers to become ClassPass clients as well, are there various incentives you're going to be offering? Are there ways that the two are going to be working together that are going to make it more attractive for people to also sign on to ClassPass?
Well, the number one thing that we're looking at right now is more of a product integration, so that aspects of ClassPass can appear within MindBody's core operating system. So think about the dashboarding and the performance results and information on class pricing and utilization and so forth. ClassPass has a depth of knowledge around this and some very intelligent tools they call smart tools that we're looking at bringing some of that data and information into the core product. And we think just by doing that, that it'll be a much more compelling proposition than just standalone marketing that most of the wellness space uses today.
Josh, when I first saw this deal, I couldn't help but to think when Facebook bought Instagram, is that a valid comparison?
Yeah, I think it is, because also in that type of a transaction, there was a desire to keep a very strong brand and keep the teams in place. And so as we look at the complementary aspects of the businesses, 97% of Mindbody's employees are focused on our B2B operations, whereas 100% of ClassPass's team is focused on its B2C. So we really see the opportunity to continue investing on both sides, both in B2B and in B2C. And the $500 million that we secured from Sixth Street as part of this acquisition will certainly enable us to do that.
Right. And Sixth Street, known for investing in companies like Airbnb and Spotify. Looking at some of the numbers here, 9 in 10 of the top activities right now booked on ClassPass are for in-person experiences and classes. I mean, ClassPass definitely struggled during the pandemic, right? There wasn't anywhere for people to go. And a lot of people paused or canceled their subscriptions. So besides that figure I just cited, give us sort of a state of play of what ClassPass is looking like right now in terms of engagement.
Yeah, so I would just first start with the broader industry. I mean, 90% of consumers are looking to get back to in-person classes as soon as they're able to, and 80% of consumers are saying that wellness is more important than ever. So what we see on the ClassPass side is that when a market has reopened and subscriptions have been reactivated, ClassPass actually proactively pauses subscriptions versus the consumers doing that. And so as they're reactivating and they attend one class, then they start attending more classes at 110% of what they did pre-COVID. We also see on the Mindbody side, through the B2B lens and the transactions that run through our system, that on average, when a market reopens, the businesses are booking above their 2019 levels. So we really see the surge back into in-person classes. And that's why, as you mentioned, 9 out of 10 classes on ClassPass are being booked in-person versus virtual now.
Josh, this is a pretty, it just became what looks to be a more compelling business here, a more compelling business to potentially pitch to public market investors? When's the IPO?
Well, right now we just made the announcement and we're looking at working on the integration plans. But obviously the story here is a better together story, faster growth for the businesses, being able to expand, being able to look at industry consolidation, and certainly looking to get back to the public markets at some point. Mindbody was taken private by Vista Equity Partners in 2019. And now we have additional PE backers, including L. Catterton and Temasek and Apax, with ClassPass as investors coming into Mindbody's cap table. And we're certain that at some point in the, you know, in the not too distant future, that we'll be looking at a return to public markets. But as of today, we just don't have a line of sight on the timing for that.
And Josh, I also wanted to go back for just a moment to the ClassPass sort of shrinking and then re-expansion here in terms of engagement with users. ClassPass also cut a lot of staff during the pandemic because the business shrank. How many staff has it brought back, and is it at its pre-COVID levels in terms of the number of folks?
So it's not at its pre-COVID levels yet in terms of headcount, but it's close to 400 people. So it's a very large, very large business, and it'll be joining a team of Mindbody members that are 1,500 strong around the world. And right now I'm actually coming to you from the ClassPass office in New York City. So it was great to be here and meet some of the employees and many that have been here for 5 to 7 years. So it's really nice to see what's going to happen with the cultures when we bring these teams together.
I think that calls for a group team workout, Josh.
Excellent. I'll have to ditch my jacket for that.
Definitely. Yes. I think that probably would be a good idea. Josh McCarter is Mindbody CEO. Let's keep in touch, Josh. Looking forward to talking to you again.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. In today's Crypto Corner, the company that pretty much sparked it all when it comes to NFTs crossing the barrier outside the cryptosphere into the world of athletics, Dapper Labs, the parent company behind NBA's Top Shot, the company that had been rolling out clips, collectible digital clips of NBA games that everyone was going crazy about. Now, extending beyond just the NBA, of course, the NFL also getting in on the action as Dapper Labs moves into that. Also partnering up with NBA star Kevin Durant's Boardroom to get some more behind-the-scenes content. So much, a lot, shall we say, to talk about when it comes to NFTs and Dapper Labs. And very happy to welcome back in the CEO of Dapper Labs, Roham Garagaslu, joins us once again. And Roham, good to be chatting about all this. I mean, I don't know where to start. There's a lot to talk about. You're more of an NBA guy maybe than I am. There's some throwbacks to talk about today that you're also releasing. But overall, you guys have been at the forefront of really building out, I think, some of the NFTs that a lot of people, the most excitement that we've seen on our show. So what has you most jazzed now as we kind of wrap up 2021?
Well, you said it. Today's throwback Thursday. And by the way, good to be back. Thanks for having me back. We're dropping for the first time since last offseason, running back historical moments on NBA Top Shot. So first appearances by Dwayne Wade and Shaquille O'Neal and Allen Iverson. And that's happening in about a half hour. So that's got me super excited. But of course, as you mentioned, NFL, Kevin Durant jumping on board, Carlos Puyol being our ambassador for the new La Liga product. And then, of course, everything that we're doing is running on the Flow blockchain. And right now there's a whole Flow festival going on. So dozens of other companies building on Flow are dropping NFTs, and some of them are for free. So if any of your listeners are paying attention and wanting to get into NFTs for the first time, October is a month to do it.
Yeah, it's been a wild year. I remember kind of you and I chatting and kind of explaining what this was all about earlier this year. You've got, full NBA season now, I suppose, kind of under the wrap. I mean, when you look at the numbers, right, and what you did with NBA Top Shot this year, and maybe extrapolate to the NFL side of the business, I mean, what are you expecting to see when you match those numbers up?
Well, I mean, the reality is NBA Top Shot is still very much in beta. We launched the beta this time last year, so it's been about a year. We're still about 1 million users. About half of those are paid users. So super early days, and we're excited because the NFL just takes things to the new level. It's the most passionate fan base in the world, and a short season, but a really, really exciting one. And 400 million fans with NFL revenue $15 billion a year. These are fans that really spend and are devoted to their sport. So we think that by having NBA, NFL, European football, and then expanding from there, we can bring all of the world's sports fans on you know, the only real trusted NFT marketplace has processed about $1 billion in transactions, fully, you know, identity verified and sort of out in the open. So we're just excited about building those network effects and sort of taking us from the, you know, million users we have now to the 3-4 billion sports fans around the world.
Roham, I will say, as a big NBA fan, the throwbacks are very exciting for me personally. But talk to me about your partnership with Boardroom and Kevin Durant. What kind of content are you looking at?
Well, the exciting thing about Kevin and Rich at Boardroom is that they're thinking about our partnership about in a much bigger way than most people would. And they're coming at it, obviously, Kevin's on-court persona. He's absolutely incredible, one of the greatest basketball players of all time. But with Boardroom, we're actually going to be engaging and creating content that helps explain what we're doing here to the next generations of basketball fans and to people who don't know what NFTs are, who don't care about blockchain, but what they care about is engaging with their favorite players, their favorite teams. And in fact, you know, we're trying to learn this new asset class. I mean, the Boardroom has done amazing work explaining trading cards, getting into collectibles. And we thought it's about time to kind of join forces and do the same thing they've been doing for the physical world for the digital world, because Kevin can get much more involved from an editorial standpoint, selecting his favorite moments, explaining what was going through his mind when he was actually going through and creating these legendary moments on court. And now, of course, bringing in others to kind of give their perspective as well. So it's a multifaceted partnership, and you know, it's already off to a really good start. So I'm very excited about this new season.
Yeah, I gotta apologize because the numbers move so fast; it's so hard to keep track of all of the money coming in terms of total sales, right? And we just showed a little bit in terms of total NFTs for Q3. This is, of course, you know, inclusive of what numbers you guys put up. But all across everything, including everything sold on OpenSea too, a record quarter in Q3. I assume probably we might see that surpassed in Q4 here. But when you look at your own numbers, just want to make sure, I think you guys crossed the 700 million in total sales, in less than a year, it was like 8 months or something. When you look at maybe the expectations for the NFL, I'll push for a number here because I don't really know if it's going to be 2 times, 3 times that. What looks like success to you?
Well, I think even the NBA product's barely getting started. But success looks like, you know, adding zeros rather than multiplying. But look, we don't actually, the transaction volume is one piece. And by the way, that 700 million number, that's peer-to-peer trading volume. So that's sort of happening in terms of secondary sales. We've got another 80, 90 million of primary sales to sort of add to that number on the NBA side. And we think that's going to continue, as in, you know, for every $9 that the community makes, we make a dollar. And that's a really healthy balance between sort of primary and secondary sales. So we expect that to continue in the coming years. You know, and NFL as a sport is about twice the size of NBA in terms of just dollar volume, about 400 million fans, et cetera. But NBA is also very global. We think that we're, you know, top shot and the NFL product, the La Liga product, it's going to actually change the dynamics here because it's going to bring a global fan base into NFL, and it's going to maybe take the sort of passionate NFL fan base and expose them to new products. So, you know, I mean, in terms of numbers, I think we are barely getting started here. Less than a million users on Top Shot, less than a couple hundred thousand monthly actives on OpenSea. I would expect the next year to start adding zeros to these numbers. And again, because these are digital collectibles, and that means they're much lower friction. When I open a pack, I can put it up and sell it. And if I sell something for a dollar, I pay 5 cents in fees, or at least on the NBA Top Shot marketplace, because it's low fees and very, very accessible. So that kind of dynamic is more and more people hear about this asset class. You know, new NBA season is starting right now. Q4 is actually a really big year for crypto. It's going to accelerate really quickly.
It's been fascinating to watch. And now, finally, as NFL comes into the mix here, a little bit more reason for me to be paying attention, not just my brother who's been all around the NBA Top Shot stuff. But Roham, I appreciate you coming back on here to chat with us. Come back soon, man. And congrats again on everything. The CEO of Dapper Labs there, Roham Garagoslow. Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live as we focus in on the opportunities here in cybersecurity. One of the names, one of the giants, I should say, we've been tracking in that space, seeing a nice 10% pop over the last 2 days as investors digest the latest coming out of their showcase day. That would be Okta. And what they're doing to bear the fruit from their $6.5 billion deal to acquire Auth0. Of course, Okta itself has been a leader in the identity management space there online. And for more on what the company has planned, very happy to welcome back into the show the CEO of Okta, Todd McKinnon, joins us once again. And Todd, there are a lot of things coming out of that showcase, but a lot more in terms of what investors should expect with that partnership with Auth0. I mean, what has you most excited about maybe what lies ahead in the weeks, months, years to come?
The most exciting thing for our team at Okta is the market opportunity. We have a massive market opportunity, $80 billion TAM across both our workforce identity business as well as our customer identity business. And you mentioned Auth0. We're really excited about the leg up that gives us in this very important market of customer identity, which by itself is a $30 billion market opportunity. And Auth0 brings to us this amazing developer experience, because if you think about every organization in the world, from governments to private companies in every vertical industry, they all have to have better digital experiences for their customers and their citizens and everyone that they want to reach with a great mobile app or a website. They have to do that to stay competitive. And that experience has to be identity first. It has to be specific to an end user. It has to be very easy to use. There, you can't have onerous registration and password resets, and it has to be secure. And our customer identity products and the Auth0 product help us do just that.
Have those opportunities you just pointed to shifted along with the security threats that we've seen? It feels like we've seen a ramp up in ransomware attacks. And I wonder what those conversations have been like for clients now that there's more awareness.
Well, every organization is trying to do more with technology. You talk about it on your network. Everyone talks about the opportunities with technology. And that is impacting organizations on the tools they give to their employees. So they want those tools to be modern and cloud-based and easy to use and let employees do their jobs. And as I just was talking about, they want their customer experience to be amazing and have the great mobile app and a great website. And of course, all of these apps and people accessing these apps from home and from cafes and different types of remote work, that increases the security risk. So security is on top of everyone's mind. And just like digital experiences are identity first, security is becoming identity first, meaning that the old world of trying to secure things with a firewall or a network just doesn't work anymore. You have to have a system that really controls what an end user can do, what they can't do, not make the policy tied down to the network or the device, have that security rule and the security posture, follow that end user, whether they're on your website as a customer or whether they're an employee connecting from their home office, from your office, or anywhere in between.
Yeah, and Todd, I mean, maybe some people wouldn't have known that, you know, this was a deal, the Auth0 acquisition was one that you pursued for years. So I'm sure you're stoked to kind of see it get put into implementation here and build out some real things. For me, just kind of around the showcase, Okta Workflows seems like it's pretty important when you're talking about the customer side and kind of going through some of these things, not having to wait for kind of access to be granted. I mean, what does that unlock? It sounds like it's going to begin rolling out in November of this year, so not too far off. I mean, how important is that step up for Okta as a company as a whole as you roll it out to clients now?
It's critical. It's called Workflows for any identity use case. And if you take a step back and look at the landscape, what's happening out there is there's thousands and thousands of different companies making technology and trying to provide it to every organization in the world, thousands of different innovative solutions. But customers are really standardizing on a few very important core platforms. They're choosing a platform for collaboration, for infrastructure computing, maybe for customer relationship management, HR systems. There's 5 or 6 or 7 really core platforms. And I think when we look at our market opportunity, it's really important that we establish identity and our identity platform, broadly speaking, as one of these primary clouds, one of these top 5 or 6 most strategic clouds that our customers and every organization in the world standardizes on. And if you're going to do that, you have to support every identity use case that a customer wants to accomplish, whether that's onboarding an employee and giving them access to all the accounts they need to be productive, or that's registering a new customer on your website and integrating that with the marketing systems and the other systems that you have to have integrated to make a great customer experience. And at the heart of all this is workflows, and every organization needs to program those workflows to do exactly what they need to do for their business. And that's what this capability workflows for any identity use case accomplishes.
The casual dining chain Bar Taco continues to expand and retain its workers during the pandemic. So how are they doing it? Joining me now is Bar Taco's co-founder and CEO, Scott Lawton, along with Yahoo Finance's Karina Mitchell. Scott, welcome to the show. So the labor shortages we keep hearing about that are wreaking havoc among lots of different restaurants in the country. Have you experienced that at all at Bar Taco?
Of course we have. Everybody's experienced it. I think we fared our way through it pretty well. We are pretty much hired up now. We're actually doing a hiring in Washington, D.C. for our new location, and we have a line out the door for applicants. So we're really excited. We're starting to see a lot of positive movement in hiring.
I'm really surprised, sir, by one of the facts that you sent our way, which is that you pay entry-level staff $45,000, yet you've been able to increase EBITDA to 30%. How do you do that? The National Restaurant Association, for example, said half of all restaurants in September couldn't make their rent. How do you survive and pay a fair wage?
We were able to leverage technology. We actually use ordering at the table with your phone. And in doing so, we eliminated the typical waiter position. So now we have food runners and drink runners who are bringing the product back and forth, making sure the tables are cleared. And we have managers on the floor who are actually making sure that the guest experience is great and making sure that everyone's engaged and having fun. So in doing that, we were able to actually reallocate the tip pool to the kitchen. So in spreading that out, we're able to pay the state minimum wage. And then when you take the tip cut, it actually takes everybody up to over $20 an hour, averaging around $22, $23 an hour. We're as high as $30 an hour in some markets. So everyone makes the same money who works hourly. And, you know, it starts at about $45,000 a year if you're working full time.
How are you weathering the supply chain issues? Has your business been impacted? Is it tougher to get certain ingredients right now? How are you dealing with it?
Yeah, we've experienced it just like anybody else. Like our glassware, we had to change all of our glassware because we just couldn't get it any longer. We also are, you know, waiting on restaurant equipment for some of our build outs. It's holding us up a little bit, but it's sort of splotchy in different areas. It hasn't been crippling yet to us, but we certainly are seeing it happen.
And tell me, sir, what about as far as passing on cost to customers? Are you having to increase the price of menu items? Have you streamlined what you're offering on your menu at all to compensate?
We've had one price increase in the last year, about 5%, which sort of followed commodity pricing. We haven't done anything else, and we don't intend to. Because of our labor model working, we don't feel the same pressure that other businesses are feeling on their labor. So, you know, a lot of the price increases that I hear other restaurants are doing is because they have to raise their pay for employees. But with our new model, we haven't felt that same pressure. So we're able to pass it along to our customer, the savings.
Now, like a lot of different industries, you had to pivot pretty quickly at the onset of this pandemic and get a delivery platform up and running. You did a number of other things, too, to help the business sustain and then ultimately grow. What from that time do you think is going to stick around post-pandemic, Scott?
Well, you know, I think digital ordering is here to stay in some form or another. We can't, you know, everybody, including my parents now, know how to order food for delivery on their phone. So that was not the way it was pre-pandemic. So, you know, we've seen a big increase in our takeout business, and we've actually recreated our takeout business in a way that we're really proud of it. And we think that's going to be a part of our business forever. We also think that customers have a little more comfortable or a little more comfortable with digital engagement. So we want to utilize that in ways, not that it takes away from the service experience for the customer, but in ways that they enjoy it. And that it makes their lives easier.
How much of your business is now sort of takeout and delivery versus people returning to the restaurant? How does that break down?
Well, pre-pandemic, I think takeout delivery was about 7% of our sales. And, you know, it went as high as 100%. And during sort of last winter, I would say it was 25, 30%. We're down to about 12 to 15% now, depending on the location. We expect it to go up a little bit in the winter as our patios close and our capacity shrinks in the restaurants.
I want to switch gears for a minute and talk about your restaurants and climate change, because I know you've made a big investment in reducing the restaurant's carbon footprint. You were able to offset 11,000 metric tons of carbon this year. What was the inspiration behind that, and how are you able to afford to do that?
Well, the inspiration was we just see what's going on in the world, and I have five kids, and I think about it, and we want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. I mean, that's the inspiration. The challenge for our industry has always been, how do you do that? It's the restaurant business. It's hard. There's a company called Green Places out of North Carolina that has created a way where you can buy and offset your carbon footprint. They have a calculator that they developed through UC Berkeley that really helps you figure out what your carbon footprint is. And they've set up partnerships with different companies that are planting trees and doing all sorts of green things that can help us offset. So normally that was never something available to smaller companies. It was only available to big companies that could create a division to figure out how to do it. So we were really excited about the idea of being part of it. And we also saw it something as being really important to our customer, which is a young clientele, and also our employees. So for us, you know, we see it as something that's going to attract great employees, that our customers are going to be proud to eat there. And we saw it as a real investment in the business.
All right. Scott Lawton, co-founder and CEO of Bar Taco. Good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Let's turn to the latest from D.C., because the White House laying out its plan on how to ease some of the strain that we are seeing in the supply chains over the last several months. Now, part of that plan that we heard from the Biden administration is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week operations in the ports of Los Angeles and also in Long Beach. The Biden administration also pushing for the passage of the infrastructure bill, saying that that is going to help address some of the issues that we're seeing today. So let's talk a little bit more about this. And for that, we want to bring in Mike Pyle. He's the chief economic advisor for Vice President Kamala Harris. Mike, it's great to see you. The vice president met with the leaders of the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach yesterday. I know that that's just one of the steps that the Biden administration is taking. But talk to us just about how the Biden administration plans to address this and why you're confident that this will actually help resolve some of the issues that we're seeing today.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. The vice president met not just with the leaders of the ports of LA and Long Beach yesterday, but with a range of stakeholders around those ports. You know, the longshoremen, the Teamsters, leaders of our business groups, including the major retailers and the shipping companies like FedEx and UPS, they all have a role to play here. You know, it's not enough for the ports to go to 24/7 if the goods just stack up on the port. And that's why it's so vital that, you know, there's the labor there from the longshoremen to unload the boats, why there's important that we have the Teamsters there to get them off the ports and into commerce. And then it's important that we have these commitments from the major retailers, from the shippers, that they're going to make use of those nighttime hours. We think kind of taken together, that is a set of steps by an important set of actors that's really going to unlock a lot of the challenges we've been facing in the port system.
Thank you for joining us, but good intentions. How do you get, for instance, Walmart, which says they're going to play a role in this, how do you get past the fact that there may not be enough drivers to drive trucks? We've already seen that increasing wages has not attracted people back into the labor shortage in some ways. So how do, one, you get the truck drivers in place to deliver this stuff? And would it be necessary to perhaps relax some of the regulations in order to accomplish this?
Well, that's why we thought it was so important that the Teamsters were a part of the discussion yesterday. You know, obviously, you're exactly right. You know, trucking is a key part of this challenge, and making sure that they're a part of this discussion, that the truck drivers that they represent are a part of this solution, that's going to be essential to making it work.
Okay, so what can the Teamsters do to get people behind the wheel of a truck?
Well, you know, they represent, you know, tens of thousands of truck drivers across the country. Those are our drivers. Those are, working men and women who are going to be a part of the solution, which again is why it's so essential that, they and their commitments are a key part of the solution here.
Mike, when we talk about how significantly this could potentially slow the economic recovery, what's your latest reading on that, just in terms of what we could see play out over the next couple of months?
So I think we're really encouraged by some of the trend lines that we're seeing in the economy. We got a reading this morning on unemployment insurance claims down below 300,000 for the first time since the start of the pandemic. That's a level that's over two-thirds reduced from the level we saw when the president and vice president took office. There is more work to do, clearly. But I think, again, some of the trend lines we're seeing around the labor market, around unemployment insurance claims, the fact that U.S. GDP is now back above the level that we saw going in the pandemic, really the one country in the G7 for which that's true, I think is encouraging to us around the trend lines. And we're going to be monitoring those very closely as we look ahead.
Would there be a way to prioritize which ships, which containers get unloaded? I would assume that the manifest indicates what container contains what, or would that just be too much of a logistics nightmare? Because it would seem to me, for instance, semiconductors might be one of those things that's a priority over toys from China.
So, I think one of the important things to really recognize and acknowledge here is this is a private system with private actors. And what the federal government can do is say, port operators, unions, major businesses need to get around a table and, figure out how to coordinate in ways that can unlock some of this. But some of those kind of very specific choices about how to make this work hour to hour, day to day, those are rightly in the hands of the private actors that are, really at the core of the system and the core of making it work.
And Mike, speaking of making it work, we know that Vice President Harris, this is something that she has been talking about now for many months. Back in August, she was over in Asia. She was in Singapore saying that, hey, we could actually see a delay in Christmas presents this year as a result of this. Is this something that should have been addressed earlier? And I guess, why wasn't it a bigger concern going back just a couple of months ago?
So, I might just push back against the question in the sense that, this has been something that the vice president and the president focused on for months. So the president announced the supply chain task force at the very start of June. That followed on, work that a number of folks around the White House have been doing, identifying some of these emerging pressures as early as the spring. We've seen a set of announcements over the course of months since then around semiconductors, around the vice president's visit to Southeast Asia, around food prices, which has been a core source of focus around here, and then around ports. The appointment of John Pecari as the ports envoy at the end of August, and then the announcement yesterday reflective of, hours and hours and hours of work that the port envoy put in with all of these stakeholders to get to the place we were yesterday.
Understanding the teaming of private sector and public sector to make this work. So help us understand, how do we measure if it is working? I had started the whole block by saying 72 days to Christmas. What's the criterion by which the government, as well as those of us who are just part of this 330 million people in our society, can say it's working or it's not?
So, I think we're encouraged by some of the data that we're already seeing. The Port of Long Beach went to 24/7 operations a couple of weeks ago. What's called the dwell time, the amount of time that it takes for a ship to be fully unloaded, has gone down pretty considerably since they went to 24/7 as a result of some of the unclogging that was able to happen as a result. We're looking at metrics like that, dwell times, the number of ships at port. These are going to be important metrics for us to be kind of monitoring very closely day in and day out in the few weeks ahead. And I know we're going to be very focused on seeing what sort of progress we have, 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks out, and make adjustments as need be.
Mike Pyle, Chief Economic Advisor for Vice President Harris, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. And we look forward to having you back on Yahoo Finance.